We're on. Okay, so what happens here at the university is that when we have a guest distinguished person from Harvard lecturing at 5 o'clock in the room, they come in early and they bring the superior equipment. They bring the new transmitter. They bring the new powerful receiver. They bring the better microphone. And they certainly didn't intend for me to use it, I'm sure. So I feel like the stepchild who's discovered that the siblings are out and I get to play with their toys. And what I'm going to do is wear out the battery so that when Professor Wilson gets halfway through, it'll be done. Several people have asked about accessing his lecture, and I don't know if you can't stay. I don't know, but I will find out. They have been routinely videotaping all of the president's distinguished lectures, and I assume they will videotape today. In fact, they will probably come in before we are done, and they'll make a huge commotion back there setting up video, and they'll be annoyed that I'm here. But anyway, I will find out how to, if they record it, I will find out how to get it and let you know. One item of business, which is that we have an exam a week from Monday, and therefore I need to schedule review sessions for next week. There will be one after class on Wednesday a week from today, as usual, in here. That's already scheduled. The one on Sunday evening last month was very popular. You want that one again, Sunday evening? Okay. The Thursday afternoon at 2 was sparsely attended. How about 4 people or so? So the question is, do we want one Thursday afternoon? And if so, should it be at 2 or should it be later? Do you want one Thursday afternoon? Do some of you need that? Raise your hand if you want. Raise your hand if you want one on Thursday. Friday is not an option. Sorry. Unless you want to do one.
No.
Okay. So the Wednesday after class, Sunday evening. How many of you do want one Thursday afternoon? Okay. Thursday evening. Okay. That's not a popular time. How about Saturday morning at 8? Yeah. I'm not going to offer Saturday evening. Okay. If my schedule changes, how many of you really would like one on Friday afternoon if I could do that? Okay, so okay, so it looks like we just don't need the Thursday. Email me if you're frustrated by that. Sunday at 7, does that work? Okay, I'll get a room. Okay. Do we have any other business? Okay. The exam analysis exercise, I see people are finding. The instructions are on the web. It's worth a possible 8 points. The multiple choice answers and the questions are posted on the wall during the day outside C150 Living Learning. Some people have had difficulty figuring out how to do that in their schedules. I will have it up on Sunday when I'll be here most of the day, so I will have it up Sunday. It's usually up till 6 or so in the evening. So if it is if you have some major frustration with that, let Julie know and she'll solve it. It's usually up during the week till 6 or so, essentially whenever I get away. If the last person in the office takes it down rather than leave it up overnight. Okay. We were talking about, yes. It's usually up by 8. The first person in the office puts it up 8 in the morning. So it's up all day, whether I'm there or not. And then it gets taken down at whatever somebody declares to be the end of the day. Okay. I was talking about Piaget, and I want to emphasize several points about his approach. As you're trying to read it in the text, I would recommend, as you read it, the sections of the text on cognitive development have other things in them as well. There's stuff on language and other aspects of intellectual development and school performance and things like that. I would recommend that you make an effort to read each of the sections on Piaget by themselves in order and think about how each of these stages that are described, one for infancy, one for early childhood, one for middle childhood, one for adolescence, think about how those descriptions relate to each other. Because the text does what everybody else tends to do with Piaget, which is to think of his approach as including four discrete stages that you somehow magically leap from one to another through. And that's not what he's talking about. But the way the text is set up, without integrating the four major stages, the way that text is set up encourages that kind of thinking. So let me see if I can counteract that. What Piaget was trying to do was to describe how knowledge develops. And at any particular time in your life, what can you do, and what do you have to know in order to do that? Okay. So he developed, as I said, a series of tasks that he observed children doing. And then he did the analysis of what kinds of things do you have to know. What does the child have to do in order to, not in order to solve the task, but in order to approach the task and deal with it in whatever way the child is dealing with it, which may or may not come to the point of having the right answer. That means that in order to understand knowledge, you also have to be able to understand what it is the child doesn't know, what the child can't do. And as he tried to describe the changes across time in what children know and what they can do with tasks, he eventually developed his four stages. And you should know their names and basic characteristics. And it also helps if you know the order of them. And that's good. We're not able to. Oh. So the fundamental stages in his theory, simple, there are just four of them, and they follow in order. The sensory motor period is what infants are in, and what that means is that they know the world through their senses and through their motor activities. They are learning how the world works. They're learning to comprehend it, to solve problems in it, through their senses and through their actions. All of the senses and all of their actions. That's the only way they can know it. As they move up into early childhood, they add to their sensory motor understanding of the world what Piaget calls an intuitive or pre-operational understanding of the world, which includes the ability to represent their experience and the world linguistically. What they are doing is adding words to their actions and their perceptions. They're learning to label their experience or to represent it linguistically. As they move up toward the 5, 6, 7 years of age, they improve the way they put words together and the way in which they understand sequences and concepts so that they can deal with the relationships between things in a logical way, the way things are organized. And they can do that in a way that gradually becomes systematic and logical. They're able to deal with classification systems. As they go through puberty, typically, they begin to be able to deal with more abstract levels of those relationships and classifications. So they can, for example, think about how two relationships are related to each other. They're creating abstract systems. Now, the key to using Piaget's scheme is to understand that the person is developing through these four stages, and each represents the addition of new ways of understanding. So you start with your sensory motor abilities and understand the world through your perceptions and your operations, and then you add words to those. You continue to understand the world through your sensory systems and your actions in it, but now you can label your actions. You never stop. You never leave the sensory motor knowledge behind. You continue all of your life. You're adding the ability to represent it linguistically. So you don't stop being a sensory motor learner. Think about learning to drive. In my case, it was learning to sail in my 40s, to sail a boat. For my mother, the sensory motor learning has included learning to navigate with a walker, with a basket on the front. It changes how much room you need compared to how you walk. Okay, so now her sensory map, her perceptual map of the world, includes making space for the basket on the front of her walker. So we continue to experience and understand the world in sensory motor fashion, but we add the ability to represent it linguistically. And then as we enter school age, we add some understanding of basic logic and the ability to organize concepts and think about the way they're organized logically. And then as we enter adolescence, we begin to be able to deal with them on a more abstract level. we continue using all of the skills that we developed in the previous period. We're adding more abstract levels to it. That's an important distinction. What I'm leading up to is looking at the tasks that we have on the handout so we can look at how you use what you learned in the sensory motor period to answer those questions and what kinds of organization you use. Okay, so what I just said was that in Piaget's stages of development, you're adding new ways of representing and transforming experience. You continue to use the old ways, but you use them often in more sophisticated ways. And it's a gradual process. You're not just one day leaping from concrete operational thinking in middle childhood to formal operational thinking in adolescence. It's a gradual process with long transitions. Most of you began to use abstract logic as you entered puberty, entered adolescence, and you refined that through high school. But what we discover is that we're still consolidating those abilities through college. We're not fully competent in our formal operational thinking until usually well into our 20s. Okay? Now, this is a constructivist theory that assumes that people are constructing their own understanding of the world out of their experience in it, that that's an internal process. Nobody can give you the understanding. They can share theirs with you, but you have to create your own. And whenever we have a constructivist notion, we imply the possibility of deconstructing. In other words, if you construct your understanding of anything in a series of steps, starting with your experience, we should be able to go back through those steps and figure out the basis, the origin of whatever it is and however it is that you understand something. That was Piaget's completely radical notion, that everything you know has a foundation in your sensory motor experience. That you don't understand anything unless you can comprehend it at the sensory motor level. Even the very abstract things like democracy or love or justice or tyranny, those all have an origin in your sensory motor experience. Now, that part of Piaget's theory often doesn't get studied. People seem to be interested in figuring out what stage people are at rather than how their understanding has grown from the sensory motor experiences that underlie it. But there should be continuity in everything that we understand. Okay. Here are the points I want to try to make today. You're not going to copy these down quickly enough. I just want to run through them. I'll put them on the web. I don't want to spend enough time looking at them for you to copy them. They will be on the web. I just said everything we understand begins with our experience, our sensory motor experience. How we approach the world, how we interpret the world, how we assimilate the world changes as we develop. Each stage represents a different, more complex way of interpreting the world. What aspects of experience cause us disequilibrium? Changes as we develop. Remember, disequilibrium is what happens when the way you're approaching the world, your interpretation, your set of expectations don't work. You run into something you don't understand. That creates disequilibrium. That motivates you to get more information. But what causes disequilibrium changes as our ways of understanding the world change. When we accommodate, when we change our understanding because of the disequilibrium, that's important, but how we accommodate to disequilibrium changes as we develop. So it's a very complex, very general modification of the way we understand the world, the way we try to understand it, what happens when we don't understand it, and how we change. All of that changes so that 4-year-olds are different from 14-year-olds in what they get disequilibriated by and by how they approach that. How we understand and represent our experience changes as we develop. We constantly, through life, review our understanding. Even infants constantly review the way they understand the world. They go through the actions over and over and over again. They vary the actions that they're engaged in. They try them out in new situations to see if they still work. In that action, in that process of review, we consolidate. We solidify, we firm up the understanding we have of the world. And in that process, we also discover disequilibrium. As we review, we discover that we need to change our understanding. We find things that don't fit. And that's a constant process through life. So we review and we reconstruct. We compare to each other the various aspects of our understanding. So if you had a boyfriend when you were 15 and that broke up, and then you got to be 17 and you had another boyfriend and that broke up, one of the things people do is compare the boyfriends. They compare the experience. They compare the way they break up. And if you do that often enough, then you develop a general scheme. So you describe, well, boyfriends are, we generalize across the boyfriends. What do they have in common? And then we generalize across breakups. We say, well, when you break up, this is what happens. And those are general schemes that come about because we put our different experiences together and compare them and try to understand them. And then we apply those general schemes that we develop to new situations to solve problems. Oh, well, if I'm going to have a boyfriend now, maybe I ought to treat him differently because boys expect to be treated, based on my past experience, in the following ways. And when we break up, I'm going to deal with that one differently too. So we're anticipating, we're interpreting the next boyfriend differently on the basis of what we've learned about our previous boyfriends. As we do that, as we become adolescents particularly, we begin to construct abstract structures. So in college we learn about relationships and we discover that, oh by golly, you know, this is interesting. Boyfriends, having a boyfriend when you're a teenager can be compared to having a wife when you're an adult. I mean a husband. Well, it can be compared to having a wife too, because relationships are between two people. And the ones between adolescents, boy and girl, the ones between gay adults, the ones between husbands and wives, the ones between second husbands and fourth wives, and all of those relationships can be compared to each other. And people will develop abstract schemes or theories and write whole books about interpersonal relationships. But they do that starting with their sensory-motor experience of what? Loving mom? Having boyfriends and girlfriends? And comparing those, and then talking to other people about their experience and doing research and generalizing so that eventually we come up with a grand scheme about relationships that we can argue about. One of the fundamental characteristics of our human thinking is that we're constantly trying to identify similarity and difference. The ability to perceive difference and the ability to perceive similarity are built into every system of the human brain. And our ability to understand the world is based in large part on that ability. Differences between things mean that they're perhaps different things. Similarities give us the possibility of generalizing. Comparing experiences, looking for differences. Why is this boyfriend different from the last one? How is pea soup different from barley soup? How is butter different from margarine? How is college different from high school? How are they the same? How is this lecture hall similar and different from Angel B106? That is fundamental to our understanding of the world. I'm going to introduce a term. When two of our schemes, two pieces of our experience, have the same form or pattern, we call them isomorphic. That's from the Greek. It says two things have the same pattern. Iso meaning same, morph meaning pattern or form. Yeah, we're going to come back to that. Finding instances of isomorphism and non-isomorphism, which essentially means finding the similarities and the differences, is central to understanding and solving problems. And then finally, how we approach tasks and problems changes as our understanding develops. Now, as I said, I'll put those up on the web. When we look at the tasks that I gave you, what do you have to know and be able to do to solve them? So let's look at the first one. You all know about analogies. Remember the SATs. Some of you love them. Some of you don't. Some of us do them for fun before breakfast. Some of us avoid them like the plague. Okay, here's a typical one. These, by the way, are taken from an English test, and I usually give it the 100 items. I'm not going to give you that form of it. So I just picked out a couple of illustrative ones. Okay? How do you do this, and what do you have to know? Did you get it? You got it. Okay. Okay, so you have to know or figure out the relationship between bell and bicycle. That's easy. They both start with B. Right? Okay, so we got that one. Now, and then you have to take that relationship, whatever you think it is, to the other side and see where you can find the identical relationship. Or the analogous one. Analogy, by the way, means that when two things are analogous, it means that even though they have different content, the relationship is the same, the pattern or the form. The relationship is a form, it's a pattern, it's a scheme that can be applied to both sides. And it's an analogy when the same form applies to both sides. In other words, you're looking for an isomorphism.
Ah, I knew I'd get that word in.
I'll get that word in many times before we're done. Okay, so what did you figure the relationship between belt and bicycle is?
I don't know, I can't really explain it.
You can't explain it, but you know it, don't you? Okay, do you know it at the sensory motor level?
What?
Do you know it at the sensory motor level?
No.
No? Hmm. Well, then why, if you can't explain it, what does it mean? Okay, see, you, what she's doing is this. Okay? What she's doing is this. And then what happens when you do this? What?
A bell is like an alarm for a bicycle.
A bell is like an alarm for a bicycle. It wakes it up in the morning.
To acknowledge that other people know that you're coming.
Right. To let other people know that you're coming. So what happens when you do this? It goes ding, ding. The illustrations are everywhere. Your understanding of the bell and the bicycle is sensory motor. You can act it out. That's what charades are about. The fact that all of us have squeezed the bell, right? It's got that little lever, ding, 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 ding. And it's sort of chrome, except it's not very good chrome, and it rusts, and after a few months, it stops, okay? But we all know that. Ding, ding. So it's a warning device. It alerts other people that you're there, right? One of my unfavoritest experiences, and I have a sensory motor kinesthetic memory of this one, is that rollerblade on the bike path, and somebody comes up behind you, and instead of saying, behind you, passing on your left, which is hard enough for me because then I always have to figure out, okay, which is left, which is right. Instead of doing that, they go, ding, 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 and I panic. Okay. So I have a reflex reaction to that. So it's a warning device. The bell is a warning device on the bicycle. Then what do you do with that? You've got a relationship now. You look for the item on the left, on the other side of the is, that forms the relation, the same relationship with the car. Do cars have bells? No. Although, you know, this task is getting harder because some of you have multiple warning devices on your automobiles. You can buy them with 50 or 60 different devices. You can press whichever one you want, and you probably can get a bicycle bell. So you come up behind somebody at the crosswalk and go, ding, 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 ding. Okay, so you chose horn. Because the horn is the warning device on the car, and the bell is the warning device on the bicycle. Everybody agree? Anybody get something else? Anybody want to defend a different answer? One of the fun things about working with children, and I do this one down to about 8 years old with good readers. They know the vocabulary. It's chosen for that. They can tell you what a bell is, what a bicycle is. The fun part is that when they start doing this task, they understand the task, sort of. As I said, your approach to tasks changes as you develop. Concrete operational kids know that. Middle school age kids know that they're supposed to find the right answer. And so they look at this and they say, okay, bicycles have bells and cars have wheels. And some kids will pick wheel, probably because it's the first item that they come to that makes any sense at all. And they pick wheel. And they tell you, when you ask them, okay, explain your answer to me, they tell you that bicycles have two wheels and cars have four. And that's the difference between them. And as the examiner, you sit there and go, what does this kid not know? The kid knows something about bicycles. They have two wheels. Cars, they have four wheels. They both have wheels. This is a similarity. And so wheel is an answer that I can defend because both cars and bicycles have wheels. So there's a lot of knowledge there. And I had one clever kid who picked wheel. He was about 10. And he was wonderful because he told me that bicycles have wheels and cars have wheels and bells have wheels. Right? How many of you have experienced bells that have wheels? He's absolutely right, and his sensory motor experience included bells with wheels. Where would he have that experience? It's not quite a religious experience, but it's had in church. Any of you go to a church or a school with a bell in a steeple that you ring by pulling a rope? Why does the rope make the bell ring? Because it's attached to the wheel that is attached to the axle from which the bell hangs. And we would normally call it a pulley. It's not really a pulley. It's a wheel. It's a bell wheel. That's what it's called. And this kid had rung that, and he had been up in the steeple, and he knew that the reason the rope made the bell ring was that the bell was attached to a wheel. So now he's got bicycle has wheels, bell has a wheel, car has a wheel, they all have wheels. What's he not understand? What he doesn't understand is the very notion of analogy. That it has to be the relationship on each side that is identical. So he's missing that at 10. And in fact, what happens is that the understanding of analogies grows very, very quickly as kids move from elementary school age, concrete operational thinking to formal operational thinking. Because formal operational thinking means that you have the ability to take the relationship on the right side and compare it to all the possible relationships on the left side and sort through them until you come up with the right one. So doing the analogy requires that you have the sensory motor experience to understand what each of the words means. If you don't know, you're lost. Okay. So if you know about bells but don't know about bells on bicycles, you know. By the way, how many of you have bicycles? How many of you who have bicycles have a bell on your bicycle? How many of you have a bell that works? Two. Okay, so there is truth in this. Sometimes nobody has a bell and nobody has one that works. They won't work very long. You probably have new bicycles. Okay. And that becomes an important point because we expect you to get the analogy even though it's contrary to reality. If you don't have a bicycle with a bell, you're still supposed to know this. You know, it's in the lore that bicycles have bells. You have to have the sensory motor experience that underlies the activity. You have to have the word to attach to that sensory motor experience. So you have a lot of things that you know about bicycles and cars and engines and horn. You have to know what fourness is, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, and you have to be able to connect that to the number of wheels on a car rather than to the license plate. And you have to be able to take the relationship of bell and bicycle and take its form and apply it to the other side and sort through all the possibilities to find the one that is identical. And what you came up with was the notion that
the horn
is an auditory warning device, right? You don't have to be able to do this to say that it's an auditory warning device on a car. But that's how you figure out that it's right. What you do is create the general relationship. You create the general relationship that will apply to both sides. And if it does, you can use the same sentence, then you are pretty sure that your choice is right. So if you now translate that, now we're into abstract thinking. The horn is an auditory warning device on a car, and you know that you can then substitute the bell is an auditory warning device on a bicycle, you're home free. What you have done is create an abstract form. Right? You have to understand the notion of auditoriness and warning device, but you got it, right? You've nailed it if that's the way you come up with it. Now, a couple of important consequences happen if you can do this. What you have done, I said you've created a form. A form is a pattern. A form is a scheme. And what you've demonstrated is that these two sentences, the bell is an auditory warning device on a bicycle, the horn is an auditory warning device on a car, have the same form. The content is different. The content differs. But the relationship or form is the same. When Piaget uses the phrase formal operations, formal operational thinking, which is what you can all do, but you couldn't do it when you were children. You learned to do it as you were developing through adolescence. You developed a set of cognitive structures, ways of putting things together, that operate not on the content, but on the form. The ability to create patterns, forms, and apply them over and over again and compare them. Those cognitive structures we call formal operations. They're mental operations that let you do that. And what kids who can't do the analogies don't have is those operations. They're not available to them yet. They can talk about the content. They can generate the relationships. Bicycles have two wheels. Cars have four. Horns go hoot. Cars have engines and bicycles don't. That's why they're different. They can talk about those things using the operations that they have developed that let them deal with the content. And those are called concrete operations. They're about the content. Horn, bell, bicycle, car, engine. That's the content. And the concrete operations let you compare those. Let you talk about them. Let you put them in categories. But you have to have the set of cognitive operations that you develop in adolescence to be able to solve this kind of problem by creating a form. The use of form here should not be a problem. You know, you fill out forms all the time, right? You fill out a form. What is a form? It's a general pattern for putting your content in. Right? You put the content in it. And everybody who fills out the form fills it out the same way. But they all put different content in it. Okay? That's what a form is. It's a way of organizing information into a specific pattern so that everybody gives you the same kind of information, even though their social security numbers will all be different. Most of their names will be different. Their addresses will be different. Their mother's maiden names will be different. Their Visa card numbers will be different. But you'll get the same kind of information from everybody, and that's what this does. It creates a form so that everybody's isomorphic. That's what the form you fill out is doing. It's putting all in the same shape or pattern. In this case, you're creating a form to say that these two have the same relationship, even though their content is different. So it's an advantage to be able to do that. And one of the reasons it's an advantage is that then, having created the form, you can apply it to a new situation. You can apply it to a new situation. Just like I can create one form and have every student who ever comes here fill it out. Okay, I don't have to do that again. I don't have to remember what I need to collect from you if I'm the registrar or admissions. I just automatically give you the form and tell you to fill it in. How do we do that with this? Let's try a new content. What is the auditory warning device on a fire engine? A siren. What is the auditory warning device on an 18-wheeler? An air horn. What is the auditory warning device on a steam locomotive? Steam whistle. You take the steam, you feed it through a whistle. Same thing, you pull on the handle and it goes... Sorry, I blow out speakers occasionally when I try to do this. I'm not going to do that. Okay? You get the point is that you've created from two instances, in solving the analogy, you've created an abstract form, which you can then apply over and over and over again and keep adding content. Now, you're beginning to write a book about auditory warning devices on vehicles. What is the auditory warning device on a steamship? You got a steam horn again. What is the auditory warning device on an island in the middle of a shipping lane? Lights? Auditory warning device?
Bell?
On a buoy, foghorn. Any of you go to the clam shack at Two Lights in Maine in the fog? Don't stand in front of it. It's an auditory warning device. It will also blow your eardrums out. It's kind of neat experience to be moved by a sound, and it will do that. Okay. So there's an auditory warning device, but that's not a vehicle. We found a non-isomorphic instance. Okay, so the island or the buoy in the middle of the channel is not a vehicle. Different category. What's the auditory warning device on an airplane? Jetliner. 747. It doesn't have one. It doesn't have to warn anybody that it's around. There is an auditory warning device in the cockpit. But that's to alert the pilot. And that's activated by radar, which says, okay, there's something else up here that's close enough that we should be aware that it's there. But that's to alert the pilot. It's not to alert people on the ground or people walking. There aren't many pedestrians. Even on the taxiway and the runway, airplanes don't, they're not built with auditory warning devices. So there's a non-isomorphic instance. Okay. Uh, You all got that one, right? We don't need to worry about that. The same thing. Water and thirst. You all know that thirst is a drive state. Water satisfies it. When you're thirsty, you drink water. Curiosity is also a drive state. Disequilibrium. And when you get the knowledge, then that satisfies your curiosity. So curiosity is the best answer. A couple of you want to argue with that, but we're not going to argue about it. This one is interesting. What did you get? A leather and shoe. Leather is to soft shoe or hide as hard clay house is to brick. Now this got harder, right? Because there are two sets of things you have to choose from. So you've got to know more words, and you're not given the instance of the relationship that you have to match. So in this case, you have to generate them on both sides and play around with them until you come up with the same relationship on both sides. Yeah, what'd you get? Sure, volunteer. Did you get it? You get it? Okay. It's not whether you got it right or not. You got it, right?
I really don't know.
Okay, he doesn't know. Okay. You got it? Yes.
It doesn't matter whether it's right. We're talking about what you know and how you get it. There is no score.
Leather is to shoe as house is to brick.
Leather is to shoe as house is to brick. Why?
Because shoes are made of leather and houses are made of brick.
Okay, shoes are made of leather and houses are made of brick. What? Somebody said something over here.
It's backwards.
It's backwards. They think it's wrong. You're right. What's the problem with it? The problem is that the relationship is supposed to go in the same direction on both sides. And if shoes are made out of leather, then you got to have something on the right that is in the same order. So, you knew that. You knew that it has to go in the same direction, left to right. It can't be symmetrical and go in to out. Did you know that human beings, in fact, prefer symmetry? They prefer to have things going from outside to inside or inside to outside. And yet, if you try to answer an analogy problem that way, you lose. Because that's wrong. There is a convention, it's only a convention, that it has to go in the same direction. It has to be left, right, or right, left. Some of you who didn't know that missed three or four items on the SATs because of that. Because, in fact, that's a pretty good analogy, but it doesn't work. So, leather is to hide as clay is to brick. Leather is to shoe, because leather is turned into shoes, and clay is to brick. Those go in the same direction. I don't like it, but that's what the right answer is. Why don't I like it? Because if you think about your understanding of clay and bricks and houses and shoes and leather and hide, the better analogy, because of the form that it's going to create, is hide is to leather as clay is to brick. But that's backwards. You can't use that one. But leather is a raw or hide is a raw material that is processed into leather. Clay is a raw material that is processed into bricks. Then the bricks are transformed into houses and others transformed into shoes. So if you look at the three levels, from raw material to intermediate material to finished product, the ones that are really best can't be used because they're backwards. They don't have the same form. It would be as if you said, The bicycle is an auditory warning device on the bell. And you can't say that. You know that's absurd. The bicycle is an auditory warning device on the bell. That doesn't work. Okay? Now, let's quickly look at some of the number relations. These are fun and different. And some of you, I would guess, didn't even try these because you're math phobic. And one of the reasons you're math phobic is that you don't have enough sensory motor experience with numeric concepts, counting things, playing with patterns, to have constructed a solid understanding of math. So these sorts of things raise a lot of anxiety for you, so you don't do them. And how do you do this one? Oh, sorry. Here you're given three instances, 864, 525, 39, and then you have to deduce, what is the form that all three of those instances conform to? How are they isomorphic? They're different numbers, obviously, but they're related to each other in the same way. They are squares. Okay? They're all squares. Or the number multiplied by itself. You don't have to know squares, but the number multiplied by itself. So the answer is what you get when you apply that form to the next instance, like the auditory warning device on the fire engine. You square 4 and you come up with the right answer, which is 16. So you have 4 instances now that all have the same relationship. That's how these work. And B, the answer is loudly 2.5. Okay. This one's a problem because now you have to go backwards, but 8 doubled plus 1 is 17, so 17 minus 1 cut in half is 8, and 6 minus 1 is 5, cut in half is 2.5. Some of you didn't get it because you didn't realize you could do fractions. Now, there's no whole number that fits, but when you're dealing with numbers, you can cut them in half. Cool thing about numbers. And the one on the left is a factor of loud. 6. Okay, that's easy. How about these? Same thing, you have several instances. 1 is to 2, 2 is to 4, 4 is to 8, 8 is to 16, because you're doubling. What would the next number be if I had another blank? 32. See, you guys can do this stuff. You find the form, the relationship, and you apply it over and over again. What goes in these two? 4, 16, because each step is quadrupled. This one's more fun. 30, 25, 21, 18, 16. Now that's a fun one. How do you get that? What's the relationship? What's the relationship? It's not the same. It's not isomorphic. Oh my goodness. Everything I've been saying about isomorphism having the same pattern doesn't apply to this one. So now we have equilibrium. Disequilibrium, because we don't know. How does this one work? Well, the relationship between the first two is minus 5, minus 4, minus 3, minus 2, minus 1. 15 minus 15 is minus 0. If I had another number, another blank after the 15, what would go in it? Okay. 18, 16, 15, 15. 16. Why? I'm decreasing, I'm subtracting by a decreasing number. So the next one has to be minus minus 1. Right? If you believe in negative numbers. So what I'm doing is taking 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, minus 1, minus 2, and I'm making that the difference between the item on the left and the one to its right. So then I come back to 25, minus 4, da 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 da. But when I get to negative numbers, subtracting a negative number is the same thing as adding, so you go back up. So what we're doing here is different. We're taking two sets of relationships and we're imposing them on each other. So we're creating a system in which all the numbers change together systematically. Ooh. Wow. That's pretty scary. But that's what we're doing. And that also is a formal operational or adolescent skill, to be able to take the number series 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0 and apply it to the series of numbers that we have in a systematic way. So we have two patterns or two forms, one of which is causing the variation in the other series. Now, having taken that series, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, can I apply it to new instance? Could I start with 72 and apply the same series? What would be the next number? 67. And the next one? 63, 60, 58. Okay. So now that we have a pattern, the descending series 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, we can apply it starting anywhere. Okay. We could do it the other way. We could reverse it. And when Piaget says that operations are reversible, one of the ways that we would demonstrate that is to say, okay, 12, 12, 14, 17, 21. Well, I'm doing the same one. Almost. Almost. But it's the same relationship, but applied over and over again, starting at different points. And my very favorite is in this whole numeric thing. What goes in the first blank? 80. And the next blank? 320. How'd you get that? What's the relationship? Okay. Divide by 5. Divide by 0.25. Or multiply by 4. Same thing, right? Isn't math wonderful? Multiplying by 4 and dividing by 0.25 are the same thing. Wow. Okay. So multiply by 4. Divide by 5. Multiply by 0.25, divide by 5, multiply by 4, divide by 5, multiply by 4, divide by 5. It's an alternating series. You all got that. I know you did. Some of you got the same answer in a different way. Right? Anybody want to explain it? How you got it? Teresa. Let me see if I can draw that. $6.25 was related to $1.25 how? Okay, let me show you my way. Another alternative. 625 minus 125 equals 500. $500 minus 100 equals 400. Oh, I have overlapping triads. Okay. Same relationship. This one minus this one equals that one. If I do this one, I have the same thing. Now, what I need is something in that blank that when I take 64 away from it will equal 256, and that's going to be 320. All right? Having gotten the 320, then I can find out what's in this blank that relates to 320. Now I got to get my 400 minus what equals. So they're overlapping triads, and the key is that they can only overlap by one item. Okay, so these three are related in the same way. These three are related, and that's the same way. These three are related, and these three. Okay. That's an interesting form. Okay. Where are we? I'm going to challenge you to do the Proverbs for Monday and the combinations and permutations and see where the abstract forms are. What is it that the child has to do? And what does the child have to know to get the answer? We're going to end early so that these nice folks can come in and get set up. Oh, yes.
I wanted to, but I didn't finish my homework for tomorrow.